Hello, this is the podcast for our class on Wednesday, November 3rd, and it was class number 21, and we continue talking about affirmative defenses. We started it briefly in our last class last week, and now we continued on. Remember, affirmative defenses just means that now the defendant's saying, not saying that the defendant didn't do it or not negligent, but the defendant's saying, well, I was negligent, but so was the plaintiff. So now the focus shifts over to the plaintiff's conduct. And the conduct of the plaintiff, if negligent, would be a complete bar to the action. So that under the notion of contributory negligence, if the plaintiff's negligence in any way contributed towards the injury, the plaintiff's own injury, then the action would be barred against the defendant. It was a total and complete defense. And seen as, sort of harsh but fair, and then it became less fair and less fair over the time as more and more instances of very, very negligent defendants were getting off without any liability, and some very badly damaged plaintiffs were being denied any recovery because of perhaps their really minor negligent conduct. So they, over the time contributory negligence, there were lots of different exceptions that developed in order to make this a little fairer. And in about the 60s and 70s, in a very big change in personal injury litigation, states began adopting the rule of comparative negligence. No longer would the negligence of the defendant or the negligence of the plaintiff be a complete bar to liability. It now, under comparative negligence, was going to be just something to be compared to the negligence of the defendant. So comparative negligence changed the entire landscape of liability. And I think that's not too overwhelming a statement. Because comparative negligence was adopted in most jurisdictions by statute, you have to know what your own statute says for your own jurisdiction. Because there are different ways to treat comparative negligence. The most open-ended way, of course, is pure comparative negligence. That means that no matter how negligent the plaintiff is under pure, they can always recover. A plaintiff is more negligent than a defendant can always recover. Why would they be the plaintiff? Why would they want to sue if they were more negligent? Because perhaps they had some greater damages. So under pure comparative negligence, and that's the variety in New York, and the New York statute's an example of this, a plaintiff who is 60% responsible for their injury could still recover from a defendant who's just 40% responsible. In jurisdictions that adopted comparative negligence by court cases, in California, Levy, Yellow Cab, the type of comparative negligence is always pure. But some jurisdictions adopting comparative negligence used a modified type of comparative negligence, not completely open-ended, meaning a negligent defendant could not always be assured of some recovery. Under modified, there are two different types of modified comparative negligence statutes. One will say that the plaintiff's negligence cannot be greater than the negligence of the defendant. The other type of modified comparative negligence statute says that the plaintiff's negligence has to be less, so that under the statute that says it can't be greater, just means it can't, and that's our Wisconsin, it means that 50-50 is okay. Under the statutes that say it has to be less, 50-50 will not be okay. 49-51, it has to be, the plaintiff has to be less at fault than the defendant. So in our previous example, if the plaintiff is 60% at fault and the defendant is 40%, under neither of those two types of modified comparative negligence statutes can a plaintiff recover. So the question should come up in your mind, you mean you get to the end of the case and suddenly the jury who makes this apportionment comes up with a statement that the plaintiff was more negligent, that sort of ends the case. Yes, and isn't that a bad thing for the lawyer of the plaintiff who should have evaluated that case better and not brought it forward? So our plaintiff is out of luck, but you know, guess what? The lawyer's out of luck too, because under the contingency fee system, that lawyer will lose. But time was wasted and the lawyer's own money was wasted. So I want to make sure that you all are able to read a statute and know what it means, know what type of comparative negligence was adopted by that statute. If there are multiple parties, the question comes, again, under pure comparative negligence, you can always recover. Doesn't matter. 4, 5, 6 parties, multiple defendants. Under the system of modified, you have to look to the statute again. Does the statute say that is the statute silent on the issue of whether the defendant has to be, whether the defendant has to be compared to the negligence of all the, whether the plaintiff has to be compared to the negligence of all the defendants combined, or does the statute say something about this, as does the New Jersey statute, which allows for this combination or aggregation of fault, which is what the defendant, which is what the plaintiff then gets compared with. If the statute is silent, the plaintiff has to be compared to each individual defendant. When there are questions of multiple defendants, then the question comes up of dealing with defendants who may be insolvent, dealing with defendants who may have settled outside of court. All interesting questions, as are the questions that come up when you're dealing with defendants who also have injuries, which is, also have damages, which is the vast majority of time. It's rare that you've got a totally uninjured second party. You know, it's very common that everybody's got some damages. And as we used to discuss in the slides, and you should, make sure you understand what we're doing there. It's quite simple, rudimentary math, but you've got to understand it. All defendants, all parties to the injury, will be potentially liable to the others in their percentage of their fault, but can potentially recover from the others a percentage of their damages. So again, make sure you understand the slides that we went over in class. We talked about the issue of joint and several liability. That makes a difference if there are multiple defendants. Makes a difference if there are settling defendants, defendants who are removed because of insolvency. Regarding the issue of money between defendants, we talked about set off. Can we offset the money owed by the plaintiff to the defendant against the money owed by the defendant to the plaintiff? And most jurisdictions say no, even though it might be economically efficient, it would be just rewarding the insurance agencies who would have to pay less or perhaps nothing at all. And our plaintiffs would not get full recovery. Then we talked about what kinds of things can be compared. And can you compare just gross negligence against negligence? Generally, yes. What about intentional torts against negligence? Again, courts are leaning towards yes. But anything that the Fritz versus McKinney case demonstrates that in order for you to compare the negligence of the plaintiff, it has to relate to the negligence of the defendant. Defendant in Fritz was liable for their injuries caused by their medical malpractice. The negligence of the plaintiff was that they were perhaps a drunk driver and perhaps a substance, and definitely a substance abuser, but it had nothing to do with the actual medical negligence that caused the death. And the court said it was wrong to admit that it was too prejudicial. It didn't go to the actual negligence itself, which was not finding an artery. So any negligence on the part of the plaintiff had nothing to do with the defendant's negligence. It had nothing to do with the injury. And the court said there may be occasions where you'd want to admit the negligence. That is, if that contributes to the injury, the plaintiff didn't tell the truth, the plaintiff didn't take the prescribed medication, etc. But this situation isn't relevant to the injury. Although the court did say that maybe these factors of drunkenness and substance abuse might be relevant to damages. That is evidence that the plaintiff wouldn't have had a long lifespan anyway. But the court said it's so prejudicial that the trial should have been bifurcated. That is, a separate trial for liability and then a new jury and a separate trial for damages. So admit the evidence, but not in the liability phase. And then we talked about avoidable consequences, which you distinguish from causal contribution. Causal contribution means that your negligence contributed to the injury. So if you have a smoker who works in the asbestos plant and gets lung cancer, or Buckley v. Railroad there, that's not avoidable consequences. It might be a case where there's more than one possible cause, asbestos in the smoking. Contrast this with the plaintiff who has asbestosis and then is warned to stop smoking and they smoke anyway. Uh, and get cancer as a result. Smoking of the avoidable consequences applies if it can be shown that the smoking made for worse damages. So the seatbelt defense, it's not contributory negligent, although it might be negligent not to wear the seatbelt. Not wearing the seatbelt didn't cause the injury, so it's not contributory negligence. There's no causation. It's not contributory fault because it didn't cause the accident. It may have made the injury worse, but it didn't cause the accident. So next class, we're going to start talking about the idea of assumption of risk. There are two types of assumption of risk, express or implied. And we'll be reading the cases in that section. And I invite you to try to figure out which one of the cases we'll be reading is my very favorite tort case of the whole semester.